Ironic would that be? My grandma tracking me as I'm tracking down my mom with a private investigator. I reply, a little under the weather.
I hope you don't catch whatever he has.
Unlikely, I think, unless being a drunk is contagious.
I know you think the sun rises and sets on Chad Allen, but even if he's a good teacher, he's an irresponsible parent. Who leaves their baby alone for 2 days?
My grandmother mutters. Who leaves their baby alone for 10 years? I'm so wrapped up in thinking about my mom that it takes me an extra beat to remember that my grandmother still believes I have been sitting for Carter, Mr. Allen's freaky alien-headed kid, who she now thinks has a cold. And he's going to be my excuse tomorrow, too, when I go back to see Virgil. Well, he wasn't alone. He had me. I follow my grandmother into the dining room, taking the time to snag 2 clean glasses and the carton of orange juice from the refrigerator. I force down a few bites of fish sticks, chewing methodically, before I hide the rest of my meal under the mashed potatoes. I'm just not hungry.
What's wrong?
My grandmother asks. Nothing.
I've spent an hour making this dinner for you. The least you can do is eat it,
she says. How come there wasn't a search for her? I blurt out and then cover my mouth with my napkin, as if I can stuff the words back inside. Neither of us wants to pretend she doesn't know who I'm talking about. My grandmother goes very still.
Just because you don't remember, Jenna, doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Nothing happened, I say.
Not for 10 years. Don't you even care? She's your daughter.
She gets up and dumps her plate, which is still mostly full, into the kitchen trash. All of a sudden, I feel the way I felt that day when I was tiny, and chased that butterfly down a hill toward the elephants, and realized I had made a colossal tactical error. All these years, I thought my grandmother didn't talk about what had happened to my mother because it was too hard for her. Now I wonder if she didn't talk about what had happened because it would be too hard for me. I know before she speaks what she's going to say, and I don't want to hear it. I run upstairs with Gertie at my heels and slam my bedroom door, then bury my face in the fur at my dog's neck. It takes about 2 minutes before the door opens. I don't glance up, but I can feel her there all the same. Just say it, I whisper. She's dead, isn't she? My grandmother sits down on the mattress.
It's not that simple.
Yes, it is. Suddenly, I'm crying even though I don't want to be. Either she is or she isn't. But even as I challenge my grandmother, I understand it's not that simple. Logic says that if I have been right, if my mother never would have willingly left me, then she would have come for me, which obviously she didn't. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And yet, if she were dead, wouldn't I know it? I mean, don't you hear those stories all the time? Wouldn't I feel like a piece of me was gone? A little voice inside me says, don't you?
When your mother was little, whatever I told her to do, she would choose the opposite.
My grandmother says.
I asked her to wear a dress to her high school graduation. She showed up in cut-off shorts. She'd point to 2 haircuts in a magazine and ask which I liked better. Then she'd choose the one I didn't. I suggested she study primates at Harvard. She picked elephants in Africa.
My grandmother looks down at me.
She was also the smartest person I have ever met, smart enough to outwit any policeman if she wanted to. So if she was alive and had run away, I knew I couldn't trap her into coming home. If I started putting her face on milk cartons and setting up a hotline, she would only run farther away, faster.
I wonder if this is true, if my mother has only been playing a game, or if it's my grandmother who's been fooling herself. You said you filed a missing persons report. What happened? She takes my mother's scarf from the back of my desk chair, runs it through the sieve of her fist.
I said I went to file a missing persons report,
my grandmother says.
I went 3 times, in fact, but I never stepped inside the front door.
I stare at her, stunned. What? You never told me that. You're older now. You deserve to know what happened. She sighs.
I wanted answers. At least I thought I did. And I knew you would when you were older. But I couldn't bring myself to go inside. I was afraid to hear what the police might find.
She looks at me.
I don't know what would have been worse. Learning Alice was dead and couldn't come home? Or learning she was alive and didn't want to? Nothing they told me was going to be good news. There wasn't going to be a happily ever after here. There was just going to be you and me. And I thought the sooner we moved on, the sooner we could both start over.
I think of what Virgil had hinted at this afternoon, the third option that my grandmother hasn't considered, that perhaps my mother had run away not from us, but from a murder charge. I guess that's not exactly something you want to hear about your daughter either. I don't think of my grandmother as old, really, but when she gets up off the bed, she looks her age. She moves slowly, like all of her is aching, and stands silhouetted in the doorway.
I know what you look up on your computer. I know you never stopped asking what happened.
Her voice is as thin as the seam of light that surrounds her body. Maybe you're braver than I am. There is one entry in my mother's journals that feels like a hairpin turn. A moment where, if she hadn't reversed direction, she would have become someone entirely different. Maybe even someone here. She was 31, working in Botswana on her postdoc. There is a vague reference to some bad news from home, and how she had taken a leave of absence. When she returned, she threw herself into her work, documenting the effects of traumatic memory on elephants. Then one day, she came across a young male that had gotten its trunk caught in snare wire. This was not uncommon, I guess. From what I've read in her journals, bushmeat was a staple for some villagers, and every now and then that necessity was ratcheted up into a business. But traps meant for impala sometimes wound up entangling other animals. Zebra, hyena, and one day a 13-year-old bull named Kenosi. At his age, Kenosi wasn't part of his mother's breeding herd anymore. Although his mother, Laredo, was still the matriarch, Kenosi had gone off with the other young bulls, a roving teenage bachelor gang. He'd play fight with his buddies when he came into must, like the stupid boys in my school who shove each other in front of girls to try to get noticed. But like with teenage humans, these were just practice runs of hormones, and other males could upstage them simply by showing up and being older and cooler. This happened in the elephant community, too, when older males knocked the young ones out of must, which was biologically perfect, since they wouldn't actually be ready to breed until about age 30 anyway. Except Kenosi wasn't ever going to get it on with a lucky female, because the snare had practically severed his trunk, and an elephant without a trunk cannot survive. My mother saw Kenosi's injury in the field and knew immediately he was going to die a slow and painful death. So she put aside her work for the day and went back to camp to call the Department of Wildlife, which was the government agency allowed to put the elephant out of its misery. But Roger Wilkins, the official assigned to that game reserve, was new there.
I have a lot on my plate, he told her. Just let nature take its course.
The job of a researcher is to do just that, to respect nature, not to manage it. But even if these were wild animals, they were also her elephants. My mother would not stand by idly and let an elephant suffer. There's a break in the journal. She changes from pencil to black pen, and there's an entire page filled with blank lines. Here's what I've imagined happening in that gap.
I walk into the main office at camp, where my boss is sitting with a tiny box fan blowing stale air.
Alice, he says, welcome back. If you need more time off,
I cut him off. That isn't why I'm here. I tell him about Kenosi and about that asshole Wilkins.
It's an imperfect system, my boss admits, and because he doesn't know me very well, he thinks I will just go away.
If you don't pick up that phone, I threaten, then I will.
But I'm going to call the New York Times and the BBC and National Geographic. I'm going to call the World Wildlife Fund and Joyce Poole and Cynthia Moss and Dame Daphne Sheldrick.
I am going to unleash a swell of bleeding hearts and animal lovers on Botswana. And as for you, I'm going to bring so much shit raining down on this camp that this elephant research study funding is going to dry up before the sun sets. So you can pick up that phone, I say, or else I will.
Anyway, that's what I imagined she would have said. But when my mother actually starts writing again, it is a detailed account of how Wilkins arrived holding on to a knapsack and a grudge. How he sourly rode beside her in the jeep, clutching his rifle, as she located Kenosi and his homies. I knew from reading my mother's journals that the Land Rovers did not get closer than 40 feet to bull herds. They were too unpredictable. But before my mother could explain this, Wilkins raised his gun and cocked the trigger.
"Don't!"
my mother screamed, grabbing the barrel of the rifle and pointing it at the sky. She threw the Land Rover into gear, driving forward to push the other young bulls out of the way first. Then she pulled off to the side, looked at him, and said, "Now! Shoot!" He did. Through the jaw. The skull of an elephant is a mass of honeycombed bone, made to protect the brain, which sits in a cavity behind all this infrastructure. You cannot kill an elephant by shooting it in the jaw or the forehead, because although the bullet will do damage, it will not hit the brain. If you want to humanely kill an elephant, you have to shoot it cleanly behind the ear. My mother wrote that Kenosi was bellowing his heart out, in pain worse off than he had been before. She used curse words she had never used in her life in multiple languages. She was contemplating grabbing that gun and turning it on Wilkins. And then something remarkable happened. Laredo, the matriarch, the mother of Kenosi, came charging down the hill, toward where her son was stumbling around, bleeding. The only obstacle in her way was my mother's vehicle. My mother knew not to get between an elephant and her calf, even if that calf was 13 years old. She threw the Land Rover into reverse and zoomed backward, leaving a clear path between Kenosi and Laredo. Before the matriarch could get there, however, Wilkins took a second shot, and this one hit its mark. Laredo stopped on a dime. This is what my mother wrote. She reached out to Kenosi, stroking his body from tail to trunk, paying special attention to the spot where the snare wire had cut into his hide. She stepped over his massive bulk, standing above him the way a mother would protect her calf. She was secreting from her temporal glands, dark streaks marking the sides of her head. Even as the bull herd moved away, even as Laredo's breeding herd joined her and reached out to touch Kenosi, she refused to move. The sun fell, the moon rose, and still she stood, unable or unwilling to leave him. How do you say goodbye? That night there were meteor showers. It seemed to me that even the sky was weeping. 2 pages later in the journal, my mother had composed herself enough to write about what had happened with the objectivity of a scientist. Today, I saw 2 things I never thought I would see. First, the good. Because of Wilkins' behavior, the researchers in the reserve have now been given the right to euthanize an elephant on our own, if necessary. Second, the devastating. A female elephant whose baby wasn't a baby anymore by any means still returned with a fury when he was in distress. Once a mother, always a mother. That's what my mom scrawled at the bottom of the page. What she didn't write was that this was the day she narrowed her study on trauma and elephants to the effects of grief instead. Unlike my mother, I don't think what happened to Kenosi was tragic. When I read it, actually, it makes me feel like I'm filled with sparks from those meteor showers she talks about. After all, the last thing Kenosi saw, before he closed his eyes forever, was his mother coming back to him. The next morning, I wonder if it's time to tell my grandmother about Virgil. What do you think?
I ask Gertie. Certainly it would be easier to get a lift to his office instead of having to bike all the way across town. So far, all I have to show for my search are calf muscles that rival a ballerina's. My dog thumps her tail against the wooden floor. Once for yes, twice for no, I say, and Gertie cocks her head. I hear my grandmother call for me. It's the second time. And I clatter down the stairs to find her standing at the counter, shaking cereal into a bowl for my breakfast.
I overslept. No time for anything hot today. Although why you can't feed yourself at the age of 13, I have no idea.
She huffs.
I've seen goldfish with better survival skills than you.
She hands me a milk carton and unplugs her cell phone from its charger.
Take the recycling out before you leave for your sitting job. And for God's sake, brush your hair before you go. It looks like there's a woodland creature nesting inside.
This is not the same woman who came into my room last night with all her defenses down. This is not the same woman who admitted to me that she, too, is still consumed by thoughts of my mother. She digs in her purse.
Where are the car keys? I swear I have the first three signs of Alzheimer's.
Grandma? What you said last night, I clear my throat, about me being brave enough to search for my mom. She shakes her head so slightly that if I weren't staring so hard at her, I might have missed it.
Dinner's at 6,
she announces, in a voice that lets me know this conversation is over, before I really ever had a chance to get it started. To my surprise, Virgil looks as comfortable in the police station as a vegetarian at a barbecue festival. He doesn't want to use the front door. We have to sneak in the back after an officer has buzzed himself in. He doesn't want to chat up the desk sergeant or the dispatchers. There's no grand tour. This is where my locker was. This is where we kept the donuts. I'd been under the impression that Virgil left this job because he wanted to. But I'm beginning to wonder if maybe he did something to get fired. This much I know. There's something he's not telling me.
See that guy?
Virgil says, pulling me around the bend of a hallway so that I can peek at the man sitting at the desk of the evidence room.
That's Ralph.
Ralph looks like he's 1,000 years old.
He looked like he was 1,000 years old back when I was still working here,
Virgil says.
We used to say he'd become just as fossilized as the stuff he watches over.
He takes a deep breath and walks down the corridor. The evidence room has a half door with the top open.
Hey, Ralph. Long time no see.
Ralph moves as if he's underwater. His waist pivots, then his shoulders, and finally his head. Up close, he has as many wrinkles as the elephants in the photos clipped to my mother's journal entries. His eyes are as pale as apple jelly and look to be about the same consistency.
Well,
Ralph says, so slowly that it sounds like, well.
Rumor has it you walked into the cold case evidence room one day and never came out. What is it Mark Twain said? Reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. Guess if I ask where you've been, you're not going to tell me anyway,
Ralph replies.
Nope. And I'd be awfully grateful if you didn't mention me being here either. I get itchy when people ask too many questions.
Virgil takes a slightly mashed Twinkie from his pocket and sets this on the counter between us and Ralph. How old is that? I murmur.
These things have enough preservatives in them to keep them on the shelves until 2050,
Virgil whispers.
And besides, Ralph can't read the tiny print of the expiration date.
Sure enough, Ralph's entire face lights up. His mouth creases in a smile, and it has ripple effects that remind me of a YouTube video I once saw of a building implosion.
You remember my weakness, Virgil,
he says, and he glances at me.
Who's your sidekick? My tennis partner.
Virgil leans through the opening in the door.
Look, Ralphie. I need to check out one of my old cases. You're not on payroll anymore. I was barely on payroll when I was on payroll. Come on, bud. It's not like I'm asking to mess with any active investigation. I'm just freeing up a little space for you.
Ralph shrugs.
I guess it can't hurt, as long as the case is closed.
Virgil unlatches the door and pushes past him.
No need to get up. I know the way.
I follow him down a long, narrow hallway. Metal shelving lines both walls from floor to ceiling, and there are cardboard boxes neatly jammed into every available space. Virgil's lips move as he reads the labels of the banker's boxes, arranged by case number and date.
Next aisle,
he mutters.
This one only goes back to 2006.
After a few more minutes, he stops and starts to monkey climb the shelving. He pulls one of the boxes free and tosses it into my arms. It's lighter than I was expecting. I set it on the floor so that he can pass down three more boxes. That's it? I say. I thought you told me there was a ton of evidence taken from the sanctuary.
There was, but the case was solved. We only kept the items that were connected to people. Things like soil and trampled plants and debris that turned out to not be consequential were destroyed.
If someone's already gone through it all, why are we going back to it?
Because you can look at a mess 12 times and see nothing. And then you look the 13th time, and whatever you were searching for is staring out at you clear as day.
He opens the lid of the top box. Inside are paper storage bags sealed with tape. On the tape and on the bags, it says N.O. No? I read. What's in that bag? Virgil shakes his head.
That stands for Nigel O'Neill. He was a cop who was searching for evidence that night. Protocol means that the officer has to put his initials and the date collected on the bag and the tape to make the chain of evidence hold up in court.
He points to the other markings on the bag, a property number with a list of items. Shoelace. Receipt. Another. Victim's clothing. Shirt. Shorts. Open that one, I direct.
Why?
You know how sometimes a specific item can jog a memory? I want to see if that's true.
The victim here wasn't your mother,
Virgil reminds me. As far as I'm concerned, that remains to be seen. But he opens the paper bag, snaps on a pair of gloves from a box on the shelf, and pulls out a pair of khaki shorts and a shredded, stiff polo shirt with the New England Elephant Sanctuary logo embroidered on the left breast.
Well,
he prompts. Is that blood? I ask.
No, it's dried Kool-Aid. If you want to be a detective, be a detective, he says.
Still, it kind of freaks me out. It looks like the same uniform everyone wore. Virgil keeps rummaging.
Here we go,
he says, pulling out a bag that is so flat there can't possibly be anything in it. The evidence tag says number 859, loose hair inside body bag. He takes the bag and slips it into his pocket. Then he picks up two of the boxes and carries them toward the entrance, glancing over his shoulder.
Make yourself useful.
I follow him, the other boxes stacked in my arms. I'm pretty sure he took the lighter ones on purpose. These feel like they're full of rocks. At the entrance, Ralph glances up from the nap he's been taking.
Good to catch up, Virgil.
Virgil points his finger.
You never saw me.
Saw what?
Ralph says. We duck out the same back entrance of the police station and carry the boxes to Virgil's truck. He manages to stuff them into the back seat, which is already jammed with food wrappers and old CD cases and paper towels and sweatshirts and empty bottles. I climb into the passenger seat. Now what?
Now we have to go sweet-talk a lab into doing a mitochondrial DNA test.
I don't know what that is, but it sounds like something that would be part of a thorough investigation. I'm impressed. I glance at Virgil, who, I should say, has cleaned up pretty nicely now that he's not completely drunk. He's showered and shaved, so he smells like a pine forest instead of stale gin. Why did you leave? He glances at me.
Because we got what we came for.
I meant the police department. Didn't you want to be a detective?
Apparently not as much as you do,
Virgil murmurs. I think I deserve to know what I'm getting for my money. He snorts.
A bargain.
He backs up too fast and one of the boxes tumbles over. The storage bags inside spill out, so I unbuckle my seatbelt and twist around trying to right the mess. It's hard to tell what's evidence and what's your trash, I say. The tape has peeled off one of the brown paper bags, and the evidence inside has fallen into a nest of McDonald's fish fillet wrappers. This is gross. Who eats 15 fish fillets?
It wasn't all at once,
Virgil says. But I'm barely listening, because my hand has closed around the evidence that was dislodged. I pivot forward, still holding the tiny pink Converse sneaker. Then I look down at my feet. I've had pink Converse high tops for as long as I can remember. Longer. They're my one indulgence, the only items of clothing I ever ask my grandmother for. I'm wearing them in every photograph of me as an infant, propped up against a clan of teddy bears, sitting on a blanket with a pair of huge sunglasses balanced on my nose, brushing my teeth at the sink, naked except for those shoes. My mother had a pair, too. Old, beaten ones that she had kept from her college days. We did not wear identical dresses or have the same haircut. We didn't practice putting on makeup. But in this one small thing, we matched. I still wear my sneakers, practically every day. They're kind of like a good luck charm, or maybe a superstition. If I haven't taken mine off, then maybe, well, you get it. The roof of my mouth feels like a desert. This was mine. Virgil looks at me.
You sure?
I nod.
Did you ever run around barefoot when you were in the sanctuary with your mother?
I shake my head. That was a rule. No one went inside without footwear. It wasn't like a golf course, I said. There were knobs of grass and thicket and bush. You could trip in the holes that the elephants dug. I turn the tiny shoe over in my hand. I was there that night. And I still don't know what happened. Had I gotten out of bed and wandered into the enclosures? Had my mom been looking for me? Am I the reason she's gone? My mother's research comes thundering into my head. Negative moments get remembered. Traumatic ones get forgotten. Virgil's face is unreadable.
Your father told us you were asleep, he says.
Well, I didn't go to sleep wearing shoes. Someone must have put them on me and tied the laces.
Someone,
Virgil repeats. Last night, I dreamed about my father. He was creeping through the tall grass near the pond in the sanctuary enclosure, calling my name.
Jenna! Come out wherever you are!
We were safe out here because the two African elephants were inside the barn having their feet examined. I knew that home base in this game was the wide wall of the barn. I knew that my father always won because he could run faster than me. But this time, I was not going to let him.
Bean, he said. His name for me. I can see you.
I knew he was lying, because he started walking away from my hiding spot. I had dug myself into the banks of the pond the way the elephants did when my mother and I watched them playing, spraying each other with the hoses of their trunks or rolling like wrestlers in the mud to cool their hot skin. I waited for my father to pass the big tree where Nevi and Gideon would set dinner for the animals. Cubes of hay and blue Hubbard squash and entire watermelons. Enough to feed a small family, or a single elephant. As soon as he was in its shadow, I scrambled up from the bank where I'd been wallowing and ran forward. It wasn't easy. My clothes were caked with dirt, my hair was knotted in a rope down my back, my pink sneakers had been sucked into the muck of the pond. But I knew I was going to win, and a giggle slipped from my lips like the squeal of helium from the neck of a balloon. It was all that my father needed. Hearing me, he spun and raced toward me, hoping to cut me off before I could flatten my muddy handprints against the corrugated metal wall of that barn. Maybe he would have reached me, too, if Mora hadn't thundered from the tree cover, trumpeting so loudly that I froze. She swung her trunk and knocked my father across his face. He fell to the ground, clutching his right eye, which swelled within seconds. She danced nervously between us, so that my father had to roll out of the way or risk being crushed.
Mora! He panted. It's all right. Easy, girl.
The elephant bellowed again, an air horn that left my ears ringing.
Jenna,
my father said quietly.
Don't move.
And under his breath,
who the hell let that elephant out of the barn?
I started crying. I didn't know if I was scared for me or for my father, but in all the times my mother and I had observed Mora, I'd never seen her act violent. Suddenly, the door of the barn slid open on its thick cable track, and my mother was standing in the massive doorframe. She took one look at my father, Mora, and me.
What did you do to her?
She asked him.
Are you kidding? We were playing hide-and-seek. You and the elephant?
As she spoke, my mother slowly moved between Mora and my father so that he could safely get up.
No, for Christ's sake! Me and Jenna, until Mora came out of nowhere and smacked me.
He rubbed his face.
She must have thought you were trying to hurt Jenna.
My mother frowned.
Why on earth were you playing hide-and-seek in Mora's enclosure? Because she was supposed to be in the barn having foot care done.
No, just Hester.
Not according to the information that Gideon posted on the whiteboard.
Mora didn't feel like coming in.
And I was supposed to know that how?
My mother kept cooing to Mora until the animal lumbered a distance away, still watching my father warily.
That elephant hates everyone but you,
he muttered.
Not true. Apparently she likes Jenna.
Mora rumbled a response, approaching the tree line to graze, and my mother scooped me into her arms. She smelled of cantaloupe. The treat she must have been feeding Hester in the barn while the pads of the elephant's feet were being soaked and scraped and treated for cracks.
For someone who screams at me for taking Jenna into the enclosures, you picked an interesting place to play games. There weren't supposed to be any elephants in this— Oh, for God's sake, never mind, I can't win!
My father touched his hand to his head and winced.
Let me take a look at that,
my mother said.
I have a meeting with an investor in a half hour. I'm supposed to be explaining to him how safe it is to have a sanctuary in a populated area, and now I'll be giving that speech with a black eye that was given to me by an elephant.
My mother shifted me to one hip and touched his face, prodding gently. These moments when we seemed like a pie before any of the pieces are eaten were the best ones for me. They almost could erase the other moments.
It could be worse,
my mother said, leaning against him. I could see him, feel him soften. It was the sort of observation my mother always tried to point out to me in the field. Just the shift of body, the slide of the shoulders, that let you know there was no longer an invisible wall of fear.
Oh, really?
My father murmured.
How so?
My mother smiled up at him.
I could have been the one to deck you,
she said. For the past 10 minutes, I've been sitting on an examination table observing the mating behavior of the fundamentally alcoholic washed-up male and the oversexed, overblown cougar. Here are my scientific field notes. The male is uneasy, caged. He sits and taps his foot incessantly, then gets up and paces. He has put a little effort into grooming today, in anticipation of seeing the cougar who enters the room. She wears a white laboratory coat and too much makeup. She smells like the perfume inserts in magazines that are so overwhelming you are tempted to lob the whole issue across the room, even if it means you'll never find out the 10 things guys want in bed, or what makes Jennifer Lawrence mad. She is a blonde with dark roots, and someone needs to tell her that pencil skirts are not doing her ass any favors. The male makes the first move. He uses dimples as a weapon. He says,
Wow, Lulu, long time no see.
The cougar rebuffs his advances. Whose fault is that, Victor?
I know. You can beat me up all you want.
A subtle but measurable change in the atmospheric pressure. Is that a promise? Teeth. Lots of them.
Careful now. Don't start something you can't finish.
The male says. I don't recall that ever being a problem for us, do you? From where I am sitting making my observations, I roll my eyes. Either this is the best argument for contraception since the Octomom, or this crap really works between men and women, and I will probably not have a date until I'm menopausal. The cougar's senses are better than the male's. She radars my snark all the way across the room. She touches the male on his shoulder and flicks her eyes toward me.
Didn't know you had kids. Kids?
Virgil looks at me as if I'm the bug he's squashed on the sole of his shoe.
Oh, she's not mine. She's actually the reason I'm here.
Duh, even I know that's the wrong thing to say. The cougar's painted mouth pinches tight. Don't let me keep you from getting down to business. Virgil grins super slow, and I can practically see the cougar start to drool.
Why Tallulah?
He says.
I'd like to do just that with you, but you know I have to take care of my client first.
The cougar's cell phone rings, and she looks at the number flashing on the screen. Jesus on a cracker, she says and sighs. Give me 5 minutes. She slams out of the examination room, and Virgil hops on the metal table beside me, running one hand down his face.
You have no idea how much you owe me.
This surprises me. You mean you don't really like her?
Tallulah? God, no. She used to be my dental hygienist, and then she quit and became a DNA squint. Every time I see her, I think about her scraping plaque off my teeth. I'd rather date a sea cucumber.
They throw up their own stomachs when they eat, I say. He considers this.
I've taken Tallulah out to dinner. Like I said, I'd go for the sea cucumber.
Then why are you acting like you want her to plug and play? His eyes widen.
You did not just say that.
Ride the baloney pony, I grin. Storm the trenches.
What the hell is wrong with kids these days?
Virgil mutters. Blame it on my upbringing. I had a profound lack of parental guidance.
And you think I'm disgusting because I have a drink every now and then.
A, I think you drink all the time. And B, if you want to get specific, what makes you disgusting is that you're totally playing Tallulah, who thinks you're planning to ask for her number.
I'm taking one for the team, for Christ's sake,
Virgil says.
You want to find out if your mother was the person who left that hair behind on Nevery Rule's body? Then we have two choices. We can either try to sweet-talk someone at the police department to order up a test through the state lab, which they won't do because the case is closed and because the backlog is over a year's wait, or we can try to get the test done at a private lab.
He looks up at me.
For free.
Wow. You are taking one for the team, I say, all fake wide-eyed innocence. You can bill me for condoms. I feel bad enough, you know, without having to worry about her trying to trap you in a pregnancy. He scowls.
I'm not going to sleep with Tallulah. I'm not even going to ask her out. I'm just going to let her think I am. And because of that, she's going to do your buckle swab and fast-track it as a favor.
I stare at him, impressed by his plan. Maybe he is going to turn out to be a decent private investigator if he's this wily. This is what you should say when she comes back, I instruct. I may not be Fred Flintstone, but I can make your bed rock. Virgil smirks.
Thanks. If I need any help, I'll ask.
As the door opens again, Virgil jumps off the table, and I bury my face in my hands and start to sob. Well, I pretend to, anyway.
My God, the cougar says. What happened?
Virgil looks just as baffled as she is.
What the fuck?
He mouths. I hiccup louder.
I just want to find my mother.
Through damp eyes, I look at Tallulah.
I don't know where else to go.
Virgil gets into character, slinging an arm around my shoulders.
Her mom disappeared years ago. Cold case. We don't have much to work with.
Tallulah's face softens. I have to admit, it makes her look less like Boba Fett.
You poor kid, she says, and then she turns her adoring eyes on Virgil. And you, helping her out like this? Oh, you're one of a kind, Vec.
We need a buckle swab. I've got a hair that may or may not have been her mother's, and I want to try to match the mitochondrial DNA. At least it would be a starting point for us.
He glances up.
Please, Lulu. Help an old friend.
You're not so old, she purrs. And you're the only person I ever let call me Lulu. You got the hair with you? He hands her the bag he found at the evidence room. Great. We'll get started on the kid's sequencing right away. She pivots, rummaging in a cabinet for a paper-wrapped packet. I'm sure it's going to be a needle, and that terrifies me because I hate needles. So I start shaking. Virgil catches my eye.
You're overacting,
he whispers. But he figures out pretty quick that I'm seriously terrified, because my teeth start chattering. I can't tear my eyes away from Tallulah's fingers as she rips the sterile packaging away. Virgil reaches for my hand and holds on tight. I can't remember the last time I held someone's hand. My grandmother's, maybe, to cross the street 1,000 years ago. But that was duty, not compassion. This is different. I stop shivering. Relax, Tallulah says. It's only a big Q-tip. She snaps on a pair of rubber gloves and a mask and instructs me to open my mouth.
I'm just going to rub this on the side of your cheek. It won't hurt.
After about 10 seconds, she removes the swab and sticks it into a little vial which she labels. Then she does the whole thing again.
How long?
Virgil asks. A few days, if I move heaven and earth.
I don't know how to thank you.
I do. She walks her fingers up the crook of his arm. I'm free for lunch. Virgil isn't, I blurt out. You told me you have a doctor's appointment, remember? Tallulah leans in to whisper, although unfortunately I hear every word. I still have my hygienist scrubs if you want to play doctor. If you're late, Victor, I interrupt, you won't be able to get a refill on your Viagra. I hop off the table, grab Virgil's arm, and pull him out of the room. We are laughing so hard as we round the corner of the hallway that I think we might collapse before we make it outside. In the sunshine, we lean against the brick wall of Genzymatron Labs, trying to catch our breath.
I don't know whether I should kill you or thank you, Virgil says.
I look at him sideways and put on my huskiest Tallulah voice. Well, I'm free for lunch. That just makes us laugh harder. And then, when we stop laughing, we both remember at the same time why we're here, and that neither of us really has something to laugh about. Now what?
We wait.
For a whole week? There has to be something else you can do. Virgil looks at me.
You said your mother kept journals.
Yeah. So?
Could be something relevant in there.
I've read them a million times, I say. They're research about elephants.
Then maybe she mentioned her coworkers, or any conflicts with them.
I slide down along the brick wall so that I am sitting on the cement walkway. You still think my mother is a murderer? Virgil crouches down.
It's my job to be suspicious.
Actually, I say, it used to be your job. Your job right now is to find a missing person.
And then what?
Virgil replies. I stare at him. You would do that? You would find her for me and then take her away again?
Look,
Virgil says and sighs.
It's not too late. You can fire me and leave, and I swear to you, I'll forget about your mother and what crimes she may or may not have committed.
You're not a cop anymore, I remind him, and that gets me thinking about how skittish he was at the police department, how he had to sneak around instead of walking in the front door and saying hello to his colleagues. Why aren't you a cop anymore? He shakes his head and suddenly he's closed off, sealed shut.
None of your damn business.
Just like that, everything changes. It seems impossible that we were laughing a few minutes ago. He's 6 inches away from me and he might as well be on Mars. Well, I should have expected it. Virgil doesn't really care about me. He cares about solving this case. Suddenly uncomfortable, I walk in silence toward his truck. Just because I've hired Virgil to figure out my mother's secrets doesn't give me the liberty to know all of his.
Look, Jenna.
I get it, I interrupt. This is strictly business. Virgil hesitates.
Do you like raisins?
Not really.
Then how about a date?
I blink at him. I'm a little young for you, creeper.
I'm not hitting on you. I'm telling you the pickup line I used on Tallulah when she was cleaning my teeth and I asked her out.
Virgil pauses.
In my defense, I was completely trashed at the time.
That's a defense?
You got anything better I can use as an excuse?
Virgil grins, and just like that, he's back. And whatever I said to upset him doesn't crackle between us anymore. I see your point, I reply, trying to sound nonchalant. That is possibly the worst pickup line I have ever heard in my life.
Coming from you, that's really saying something.
I look up at Virgil and smile. Thanks for that, I reply. I will admit to you that my memory is sometimes fuzzy. Things that I chalk up to nightmares might actually have happened. Things I think I know for sure may change over time. Take the dream I had last night about my father playing hide-and-seek, which I'm pretty sure was not a dream, but a reality. Or that memory I have of my mother and father talking about animals that mate for life. Although it's true I can recall every single word, the actual voices are less clear. It's my mom, definitely. And it must be my dad. Except sometimes when I see his face, it's not.
Alice. Grandmothers in Botswana tell their children that if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, you must go together. Certainly, this is true of the villagers I have met, but it might surprise you to know that it is also true of elephants. Elephants are often seen checking in with others in their herd by rubbing against an individual, stroking with a trunk, putting that trunk in a friend's mouth after that individual has suffered a stressful experience. But in Amboseli, researchers Bates, Lee, Injirani, Poole et al. Decided to scientifically prove that elephants are capable of empathy. They categorized moments when elephants seemed to recognize suffering in or threat to another elephant and took action to change that. By working cooperatively with other elephants or protecting a young calf that couldn't take care of itself, by babysitting another's calf or comforting it by allowing it to suckle, by assisting an elephant that had become stuck or had fallen down or that needed a foreign object like a spear or snare wire removed. I did not get a chance to conduct a study on the scale of the one at Amboseli, but I have my own anecdotal evidence of elephant empathy. There was a bull in the game reserve that we nicknamed Stumpy because, as a youngster, he had lost a large part of his trunk in a noose-shaped wire snare. He didn't have the ability to break off branches or twirl the grass with his trunk like spaghetti, cutting it off with his toenails to put in his mouth. For most of his life, even when he was an adolescent, his herd would feed him. I've seen elephants create a definitive plan to get a calf up the steep bank of a riverbed, a series of coordinated behaviors that includes some of the herd breaking down the bank to make less of a grade, and others guiding the baby from the water, and more still, helping to pull her out. But you could argue that there's an evolutionary advantage to keeping Stumpy or that calf alive. It gets more interesting, though, when there is not an evolutionary advantage to empathetic behavior. When I was in Pilanesberg, I watched an elephant come across a rhino calf that was stuck in the mud of a watering hole. The rhinos were distressed, and that, in turn, upset the elephant, which stood around trumpeting and rumbling. Somehow, she managed to convince the rhinos that she had practiced doing this and to just get out of the way and let her take over. Now, in the great ecological sphere of things, it was not beneficial to the elephant to rescue a rhino baby. And yet, she went in and lifted the baby with her trunk, even though the rhino mother charged her each time she tried. She risked her own life for the offspring of a different species. Likewise, in Botswana, I saw a matriarch come upon a lioness that was stretched out beside an elephant path while her cubs played in the middle of it. Normally, if an elephant sees a lion, it will charge. It recognizes the animal as a threat. But this matriarch waited very patiently for the lioness to collect her cubs and move away. True, the cubs were no threat to this elephant, but one day they would be. Right then, however, they were just someone's babies. And yet, empathy has its limits. Although elephant calves are allomothered by all females in the herd, if the biological mother dies, her baby usually will too. An orphaned calf that is still milk-fed will not move away from its mother's fallen body. Eventually, the herd will have to make a decision. Stay with the grieving baby and run the risk of not feeding their own calves or getting to water, or leave and consider the certain death collateral damage. It's quite disturbing to watch, actually. I've witnessed what looks like a goodbye ceremony, where the herd touches the calf, where they rumble their distress, and then they move away, and the baby dies of starvation. Yet once in the wild, I saw something different. I came across an isolated calf that had been left behind at a watering hole. Now, I don't know the circumstances, if its mother had died, or if the calf had gotten disoriented and wandered off. At any rate, an unrelated herd came by at the same time a hyena trotted in from a different direction. The calf was fair game for the hyena, unprotected, luscious. However, the matriarch of that passing herd had a calf of her own, maybe a tiny bit older. She saw the hyena scoping out the abandoned calf and chased the hyena off. The calf ran over to her and tried to nurse, but she pushed him away and started to move on. For the record, this is normal behavior. Why, from a Darwinian standpoint, would she limit the resources of a calf with her own genetic makeup by nursing an unrelated baby? Although there are records of adoption within herds, the majority of allomothers will not nurse an orphaned calf. There just is not enough milk to go around without compromising their own biological offspring. Moreover, this elephant was not related. The matriarch had no biological ties to the orphaned calf. That baby, however, let out the most desperate, lonely cry. The matriarch was a good 100 feet ahead of him at this point. She froze, spun, and charged the calf. It was shocking and terrifying, and yet that baby stood his ground. The matriarch grabbed him with her trunk and tucked him fiercely between the playpen of her massive legs, walking off with him. For the next 5 years, every time I saw that calf, he was still part of this new family. I would argue that there is a special empathy elephants have for mothers and children, either their own species or another's. That relationship seems to hold a precious significance and a bittersweet knowledge. An elephant seems to understand that if you lose a baby, you suffer.
Serenity. My mother, who had not wanted me to showcase my gift, lived long enough for the world to hail me as a successful psychic. I brought her to my set in L.A. to meet her favorite soap star from the original Dark Shadows, who came on my show for a reading. I bought her a little bungalow near my Malibu home, with enough room for her to have a vegetable garden and orange trees. I took her to film premieres and award shows and shopping on Rodeo Drive. Jewelry, cars, vacations. I could give her anything she wanted. But I couldn't predict the cancer that eventually consumed her. I watched my mother shrink away until she finally passed. When she did, she weighed 75 pounds and looked like she would break in a strong wind. I had lost my father years ago, but this was different. I was the best actress in the world, fooling the public into thinking that I was happy and rich and successful, when in reality, I knew that a fundamental piece of me was gone. My mother's passing made me a better psychic. I understood viscerally now how people would grasp at the threads I could give them in an attempt to sew shut the gap where a loved one had been ripped away. In my dressing room at the studio, I would look in the mirror and pray for my mother to come to me. I bargained with Desmond and Lucinda to show me something. I was a psychic, damn it! I deserved a sign, to know that wherever she was on the other side, she was all right. For 3 years, I got messages from hundreds of spirits trying to contact loved ones here on Earth, but not a single syllable came through from my own mom. Then one day, I got into my Mercedes to drive home and went to toss my purse on the passenger seat, and it landed in my mother's lap. My first thought was, I am having a stroke. I stuck out my tongue. There was something I'd read once in a viral email about diagnosing a stroke and not being able to stick out your tongue, or maybe it was having it flop to one side. I couldn't remember. I felt for my mouth to see if it was drooping. "Can I say a simple sentence?" I said out loud. "Yes, fool," I thought, "you just did." I swear on all that's holy, I was a practicing, celebrated psychic. But when I saw my mother sitting there, I was certain I was dying. My mother was just looking at me, smiling, not saying a word. "Heat stroke," I thought, still not taking my eyes off her. But it wasn't all that hot. Then I blinked, and she was gone. In the aftermath, I thought of a lot of things. That if I'd been on the 101, I probably would have caused a multi-car pileup. That I would have traded everything I owned to hear her speak one more time. That she did not look the way she had when she died. Feeble and brittle and bird-like. She was the mother I remembered from my childhood, the one strong enough to carry me when I was sick and scold me when I was being a pain in the ass. I have never seen my mother again, although it's not for lack of trying. But I learned something that day. I believe we've lived many times and have been reincarnated many times, and a spirit is the amalgam of all the lifetimes in which that soul existed. But when a spirit approaches a medium, it comes back with one particular personality, one particular form. I used to think spirits manifested in a certain way so that the living person could recognize them. Yet after my mother came to me, I realized that they come back in the way they want to be remembered. You may hear this and feel skeptical. You'd be right to feel that way. Skeptics keep the swamp witches at bay. Or so I thought, before I became one myself. If you haven't had a personal experience with the paranormal, you should question what you're being told. This is what I would have said to a skeptic.